Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean, I can feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala, New York podcast.
How are you feeling? How are you feeling? What's going on in there? No, I'm not being nosy. I'm merely pointing out the topic of today's podcast, which is all about emotions. This was a talk by David Perrin, regular contributor to the podcast, which he gave back in mid-December, so a couple months ago. It's called Where the Wild Things Are. So yeah, overwhelming feelings, difficult emotions. What do you do with them? How do you manage? And what does meditation have to contribute to such an effort? So this was a great talk. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York, as always, is a great resource for new meditators and meditators of all stripes. Our introductory course called Meditation in Everyday Life, which is designed to help new meditators develop a regular practice. It's happening. Its next occurrence is happening beginning Thursday evening, March 2nd. It's a four-week course, four one-hour classes, very manageable, really will get you to hit the ground running with meditation. For slightly different flavor, our next introductory weekend intensive called Shambhala Training Weekend 1 is happening the first weekend in March, the weekend of March 3rd. And that is with Natalie Baker. So, great opportunities to dive in, to jump in, to begin to explore deeper a relationship with meditation. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org and click the link on the homepage, or go to classes and programs and scroll through all of the various offerings coming up here in winter, spring. And now,
we're going to talk about emotions tonight. Is that okay with you? we do day programs here, and they're building a condominium right behind us. So I don't think this noise was on while we were sitting, right? I guess they've decided that they need to run a generator, even though maybe there's someone working out there. So anything can set it off, right? And something about this time of year, we're a little quicker to be set off. I'll speak for myself. The triggers happen a little bit faster. Last night, so one of the things that occurred to me more than once when I was during our sitting meditation, I don't know if anybody else had any thoughts or emotions. I was thinking about last night at bedtime. So I have three children, and my youngest, my daughter, she's five. So we did the bath, and then I said, "Okay, we have to brush your hair." She said, "No, no, Daddy, I'll do it." I said, "Okay." So she runs off, and then like 45 minutes later, her hair is dry, and it's time to, you know, have a story and go to bed. And I said, you didn't brush your hair. Said, yes, I did. Please. It's like in knots back there. Okay, so she's brushing her teeth. I start to brush her hair. Ow, 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 ow. This is someone who doesn't ever want to brush their hair. And I'm thinking to myself, it's not my hair. Stop, stop, stop. And I was like, you know, it was just a few hours earlier, because the kids were going crazy, I was like, is it a full moon? So obviously I timed this talk to be during a full moon. She said, ow, ow, and she jumped off and she ran away, and I took the brush and I slammed it on the counter. I went to my partner, my wife Anne, and I said, I don't know what to do. I mean, I it's not my hair. She's gonna have knots in her hair. That's fine. It's like cut it all out. Like, you know, I just was. Anybody else have any strong emotions on the cushion tonight? Anybody want to share a little tidbit of a strong emotion that they had?
I've just, since the election, been overcome by sort of anger and anxiety and fear. And when I sit on the cushion, that all bubbles up, right? And it's difficult because it's not quite personal. And there's, you know, only so much a single person can do. So you get that feeling of being out of control.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Being out of control. Please.
So after over 15 years with the same person, which is my husband, I'm discovering that he is a serial entrepreneur. It was not apparent when we met. Very recently, like yesterday, realized that I have been enabling some extreme denial about the viability of the current business. And I'm also thinking about my practice and how when I sit, I know that I'm going to be fine. And yet, you know, there are expenses.
Yeah.
There's healthcare, there's food, there's shelter. So I'm just sort of discovering that I don't know how those things fit.
Yeah, can you say just a little bit more about how you said you know that you'll be fine? What happens?
I mean, I think, you know, I've had a practice for almost 17 years.
Mm.
And so, you know, I've been through a lot and everything has been temporary, like they said it would be. So I, you know, in some level, I know in my bones that whatever happens, it will pass and it will be okay.
Yeah.
But I think some of that has numbed me to saying what I need to say or doing what I need to do.
Interesting. Okay, good. Thank you. That's very helpful. I'm going to do one or two more, please.
I think for me, today especially, and this month usually in general, I go through checklists of just things I need to get done before the holidays. And sometimes it's exciting and sometimes it's just too much, and then that brings up a little bit of anxiety, and then I'm reminded to come back to the breath and also that things will be okay and that it's an exciting time, but it's also a stressful time.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. One of the things I was thinking about tonight was, you know, I'm pretty good at like clicking through the list. I don't know if you're this way, but like I can get through, I can make a list, I can get through it pretty good, and you know, I can, in the course of a morning, I can accomplish a lot of different things. But there's this weird shadow side to that, where if I'm really busy during a certain day, an anxiety builds up. It's one or two things. One is an anxiety, like that I'm not doing enough. So the more that I do, the more that it feels like I need to do. The other interesting component of this is jealousy, actually. So sometimes the shadow of being an accomplisher is I walk around and on my lunch break or my coffee break, and I'm thinking to myself, everyone here is doing a better job than I am. All these people out here, they have interesting jobs and they're getting ahead in their career and they're well connected and they have a lot of friends, and I don't have any of that. I have a lot of issues in my job. I feel like my career is kind of sort of moving along, but not the way some of my friends' careers are moving along. And we actually talk about that. So is anyone here familiar with the five wisdom energies or the five Buddha families? Yeah, so a few of you. So one of the teachings in Buddhism has to do with these five wisdom energies, or they're also called five Buddha families. And it's a way of looking at our emotional life, you could say, is one frame for this discussion. And looking at our wisdom aspects and our neurotic aspects. And oftentimes these things, we talk about them being codependent. They arise, they're co-emergent. They rise together. So there, you can literally picture them as the cardinal directions, and the way they're written about in the Buddhist teachings and the sutras is that it's like walking into a room and having a sense of the different directions. So it's very related to a mandala. So it's thinking about our lives and the characteristics of our personality as a mandala. So in the north of that mandala is this energy, is the Buddha of all accomplishing action. The shadow of that Buddha is a sense of jealousy. In the east is mirror-like wisdom. So this is the Vajra energy. This is the Vajra Buddha, who can see very clearly what's going on and be very sharp about giving that feedback. Any guesses about what the shadow of that is? Criticism, and even further, anger. So sort of recognizing, okay, that's what needs to happen, and then when everyone else doesn't get on the same page, starting to kind of get angry, like exactly what I do with my daughter. But you don't understand that a week from now you have knots in your hair and it's going to be bad. So you don't see that, so now I'm fucking pissed. In the south, we have the Buddha of enrichment. So this is kind of your friend who really knows how to throw an amazing Christmas party or Christmas dinner or whatever it is. They know all the stuff to buy. They know exactly the food. They make everyone feel like really warm and welcome. They just create an amazing environment. Shadow side of that is greed, holding on to these things. And then finally in the West, so that's the Ratna family, and then the Padma family in the West, discriminating awareness wisdom refers really to this person who's your friend who's really social, and everyone loves this person, right? Everyone gets along with them. They're super interested in everybody. They're asking questions. They make you feel really special. And what would your guess be about the neurotic aspect of this personality? Envy's good. It's kind of close to that.
Jealousy?
Jealousy was the one in the north, was the karma family of all accomplishing action. Clinging. Oh, I want that experience. I want that person. I want to have that. And if I can't have it, then I want it. I want you to like me. The middle one was, the reason there's five is there's a middle Buddha, and that's the Buddha of space and accommodation. And the shadow of that is kind of this ignorant side, right? Just like, let me put my head in the clouds and I won't and I can't be bothered. So we have these strong feelings on the cushion. And I was talking to some folks before the class tonight, and one of the comments was, you know, I'm beginning to see some of my subtle expectations around practice, right? So whether the expectation is that when I come to the cushion, I'm going to find my Zen place and these things aren't going to bother me, you know, or they shouldn't bother me. And there's this very subtle way in which we place these thoughts and emotions as obstacles between us and a sense of well-being. Like, when those things clear out, then I will settle and I'll be okay. Another aspect, tell me your name. Jennifer. Another very interesting aspect that Jennifer mentioned is this idea of like, well, if I become a really peaceful meditator and I can accommodate these things and I can hold them, I get really good at holding them, and then I lose a little bit of the sharpness that is the wisdom element of these strong feelings. So when these strong feelings arise, there's actually some almost like kind of a transmission quality going on. So I'm as Phil mentioned, I'm a creative arts therapist. Specifically, I'm a drama therapist. When I tell people I'm a drama therapist, they're like, no thanks, I don't need more drama. or they say, so you're a therapist only for actors. And I'm like, well, if you're there, you know, no, I'm not just a therapist for actors. I use dramatic forms in theater in the course of my therapy. I work with children, I work with adults. The other day I was working with a cab driver because when I told him that I was a therapist, then it became like he wanted a free session for the 20-minute ride. I heard all about his marital issues and everything else. But actually, drama therapy is a really interesting example of that we live in a time period, right? And working with emotions and working with our meditation practice, we live in an amazing confluence of different traditions. So drama therapy really grew out of, it has its roots very much in classical psychology and psychotherapy. So going all the way back to the talking cure and Freud's circle, his philosophies around psychosexual development. And it's interesting that some of the folks who were in that inner circle, they're all white men, and some of them actually, they split off from Freud. And a number of them, such as Carl Jung, began to take a little bit different approach, right, in their therapy. They started to work with archetypes. They started to be interested in more spiritual methods and approaches. And they started to be more action-oriented. And they were actually, what they began to open up to, it went all the way back to the Greeks. So it went all the way back to pre-monotheism. Theater as we know it today, in many of the forms that we're very familiar with, started with the Greeks. And where it really started was they would hold these festivals. So in their different city-states that they had, there wasn't any particular organized religion, but there was a pantheon of gods, and there were people's connection to nature and the elements and agriculture and farming. So they would hold these festivals or these rites. And originally it was the chorus, and eventually out of the chorus, specific actors would take on these roles. But instead of speaking to the audience, they were speaking for the audience. And often when they were speaking for the audience, they were speaking the words of poets that were, they were sort of channeling these very cathartic experiences. So things that people are dealing with in their lives, with their families, with their work, with whatever trade they were in, if they were really stuck, and you can imagine them having strong emotions just as we would, they would show up at these in these sacred circles, and they would be a part of this theatrical event, which was really about reconnecting with the gods. And we might imagine that for the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, the gods was the same quality of that we think of as the Dharma and non-dual awareness. It was this unity with something bigger, a bigger truth. And so just as we need to get in touch with something that's bigger than ourselves and we feel compelled to, they also had that same feeling. So one of my mentors, Dr. Robert Landy, who has been at New York University for many years, his work for the past 30 years in the field of drama therapy has been to look at the whole history from the Greeks onward of the theatrical tradition and to identify all the different roles that he could in all the different plays, and then approach the therapy as like we're a constellation of roles. So I'm a father. I'm a therapist. I'm a son. You know, there's the parts of me that are wounded. There's the parts of me that have ambition. I'm an artist. All of this whole constellation of roles. And it boils down to this idea of that I'm the protagonist of my own life. And I can begin to look at some of the different roles in that constellation either as supporters in the cast or as antagonists. So I might identify my guide figure, and I might identify what's getting in my way. This was very natural for folks essentially pre the monotheistic traditions. When the monotheistic traditions came along, what happened, right? There was a gradual expunging and sterilizing of what were seen as these pagan rituals. Now, just as that was happening in Europe, there was a very amazing woman who was teaching, began teaching. She was a yogini, she was a mother. She was teaching in Tibet. Her name was Machig Lubdrung. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but. And she was like an amazing pioneer as a not only a woman practitioner, but a teacher. And she originated a lineage. Her lineage was the Chur lineage. And she developed a technique working with obstacles, working with strong emotions, working with illness, working with things that we come up on the cushion. And Chud basically means cutting through. But what's so interesting is that cutting through for her was not aggression. She wasn't trying to slice the head off the hydra. Essentially, what her practice was all about was that she would invoke these demons and she would turn her body, metaphorically you could say, into a sort of nectar and she would feed them. She would take the constituent parts of her own body and awareness, heart, soul, all of it, and she would make that as sustenance for these demons. These wrathful, terrible figures. There's a teacher currently, her name is Lama Soltram Alioni. She's one of the few Western women to be ordained as a chief or a senior most teacher, a Lama. And she became empowered in this Chud practice. And she beginning to do this practice and realizing, and it was a very traditional Tibetan form, right? She had a bell, she had a drum, and she would chant the liturgy. And what she started to discover that was at the essence of this, and when she and her familiarity, and I've never talked to her about this, she has taught in Shambhala, but she has her sangha of practitioners. What she began to realize with the kind of perspective of this, these new forms of Western psychotherapy, that are, in this case the drama therapy that I'm mentioning to you, is that she could develop a process that she literally calls feeding your demons, and it's a very specific 5-step process where she leads her students through invoking the demon, right? So what that means is that when we settle on the cushion and we start paying attention to our breath, right? We're doing our peaceful abiding shamatha practice. And then something, and a strong, maybe a thought comes up, maybe it starts as a thought, and then maybe it builds to into jealousy or rage or heartbreak. Her practice at that point shifts to, and she literally says, "What you sit in a cushion and you have an open cushion in front of you, and you, in that open cushion, maybe with your eyes closed, you begin to imagine the form of whatever that emotion is. You personify it. And maybe it's not even a person. Maybe it looks like a monster." And she says, "What color is it? What's its shape? What's its temperature? Is it hot or cold? What's it wearing or not wearing?" And so this visualization exercise, this use of the imagination, which by the way is the same exact thing that the Greeks were doing, right? They were presenting these artworks, and through this representational art, they were invoking the imagination. Everything that happens around the representation in art becomes the space wherein the cathartic experience can occur, wherein we can allow the emotion to rise up and begin to give shape to this demon. And I love this. She's two questions. She says, "Now that you're looking at this demon, what's one thing about it that you've never noticed before? It's one thing about it that you've never noticed before." And then she says, "If it will allow you, if it will allow you, see if you can look into its eyes." And in my experience, in that moment of looking into its eyes is really the moment that we can know, what does this demon need from us? How can we feed it? How can we be the nurturance for this creature that essentially, most of the time in our meditation practice and when we're walking around in our lives, we're keeping this thing at bay. And it knocks on the door. I'll just keep that closed, thank you. But that's not meditation. I'm going to come back to my breath. So there's a story about this. It's called Where the Wild Things Are. I'm not going to read the whole story. If this makes you curious, I encourage you to look at it again. There's a few interesting things I want to point out. One is that Max, the boy in the story, does something that we all do, right? He wears his wolf suit and he makes mischief of one kind or another. So this is inevitable. We're still making mischief. We're not going to stop making mischief. If any of you have stopped making mischief, see me after this class. Now, Max gets sent to his room. But what does he do? Does anyone remember when he gets sent to his room? This is a big part of the story. Come on, I know you remember this. He gets sent to his room without supper. Something starts to happen in the room. It starts to grow. What starts to grow? The room turns into a forest. So what's Max starting to do? He's starting to imagine. And really it's because that's what he knows how to do. It's very natural for a child to imagine. We've been talked out of this. As adults, we're way past this. He's got an amazing grin on his face, by the way, when he starts to do this. Here he is howling at the full moon. So feel free to howl at the moon when you go home tonight. And he takes a journey. Now, who's he going to meet? What's that? He's going to meet the wild things. Now, the wild things are, is he immediately like, oh, hey, what's up? Someone just dreamed of that. So you, every single person in this room has a shape and form for their demon. I have no doubts about it. Whether you give yourself permission to invoke that is a whole other story. But no one here is lacking the ability to create their own personal demon in their head, to give it shape and form. Now, Max does something that only a child would know how to do so well, which is he looks them in the face, stares back at them. They're about to eat him. And he says, "Be still." He becomes the king. Now, for those of you who know a little bit about Shambhala, this is a very significant moment. He goes from on one page not wearing a crown to the next page wearing a crown. So he's starting to do what we call in Shambhala, which is rule. He's starting to rule his world. The demons are not ruling him anymore. He looks them in their yellow eyes, and then what do? They dance. And they swing from trees. And now he's on top of one of them. So in his own way, in the way a child knows how to feed a demon, how does a child feed the demon? They play. This is my gift to you. I'm going to play. I'm going to play like no one else knows how to play, and I'm going to play until someone tells me to stop playing. He gets lonely. This is a very tender moment where he's with these demons. He's lonely. He wants to connect back with his family. He wants to leave. But he's done what he needs to do here, right? So they've been fed. They're happily sleeping. They all have little monster smiles on them. I'm sorry, you all can't see this, but you can go home and read it. And so he says goodbye. Sails back home, and what's waiting for him? Dinner. The Greek word for demon was daimon. And their understanding of the daimon was that it was something between the human and the god realm. It was kind of this... almost like a spirit, but they understood it as intuition, as this kind of gut voice that they would hear about, well, so how do I move forward? What do I do? So it was this personal life force that gave people a sense of direction. It was a guiding figure. It was an inspirational figure. And what happened was is that it began to be defined. So it didn't have a good or bad quality. It didn't have a good or bad quality, but it began to be known as like the good things that it was telling you to do, and then like your guardian angel, and then the bad, naughty things. So as it got branded this as this kind of pagan element, you know, the church or the, Judaism, we couldn't abide by it. Couldn't abide by something where that they couldn't control, and so it turned into the demon, and it had to be in something that they had to wipe out and get rid of and create this very dualistic situation. But before that, that was not the case. The daimon or the demon was a guide. And so what I want to sort of leave you with tonight, and I'm curious to hear your perspective, but I want to leave you with this idea that there's actually a transmutation that happens when we invoke the demons and when we feed the demons. Right? Because these obstacles in our life, these sticky moments, these anxiety, feelings of anxiety, depression, chronic illness. When we turn towards them and personify them and invoke them as the demon, they actually become, they become this moment of opportunity. And so in that way, we could even maybe label them as like protectors. They're helping us to move along the path. Often it's in those darkest moments that something shifts and we, our awareness opens in a way that we further ourselves down the path. We discover something that we didn't know before. And in essence, the knock on the door, right? That's an invitation to into that. I was talking to a student recently who was saying that every time they go to sit down on the cushion, this is someone who's been meditating for a while, every time they go to sit down on the cushion, there's a little voice. And this person was on an extended retreat, so they were doing multiple sessions a day. And every session during that day, there was a, right before this person was going to sit down, there was a little demon saying, "No, I don't want to." And so when I suggested that we might personify the demon, it was a little bit like, "I'm not sure if I'm ready to go there." So if that's anybody's feeling in here tonight, it makes a lot of sense. But I thought that I would sort of offer you this different perspective on our emotions and the things that are difficult that arise on the cushion, that we often see them as something that we would like to wipe away or an obstacle, rather than a type of protector. Is that crazy? What do you think? Yes.
When I first started learning about kind of some of the Shambhala teachings, one of the things that I started doing for the first time in my life was when I had a powerful emotion to really feel it and not kind of push it away. And I was wondering if you could speak to, like, is what you're talking about just another method for getting to feeling that feeling?
Yeah, so it has the quality of what I'm suggesting is that there's the it's presenting another option, which is a little bit of a like a fast track into the felt quality. So feeling where in our body we feel that emotion, having a sense of where we might be tensing or tightening. Sometimes imagining a color, imagining a temperature to that, and really getting into a felt sensation of that is super important. And we're developing a sensitivity to our experience that we can begin to then identify with off the cushion. Like, what's going on for me right now? I'm clenching my jaw. What's going on for me that I should be, you know, conveying something to my partner, my significant other, but there's some part of me that I didn't even realize was holding back. So having that felt experience is really, it's just as important as becoming familiar with the breath as the object of meditation. In this case, it's why it's based on this cutting through practice, because we just cut right through to, okay, this thing is like fully alive in my body and it has this persona. And so am I willing to allow this persona to arise? And then when it rises in that relationship, not only am I noticing how it feels or looks, etc., but then there's this exchange that happens between me and it. And then how does it feel, not only to imagine it, but how does it feel to feed it? And that's something that is almost a little bit of another level from the feeling, right? And it's good to develop a little bit of the felt sense of our emotional life to begin with, so that when we do that process, it's like we can hang with that. We can hang with it's bringing up powerful things. But I think we don't have to become master meditation people in order to just even think that we could sit and visualize what is this thing in our body and almost take it, externalize it out of our body. That's possible too. Yeah. Thank you.
So, I just wanted to hear more about the process of feeding the demons. What you said really spoke to me, yeah. Especially the one about accomplishment and jealousy.
Yeah.
So I'm really in the middle of that right now, and yeah. I want to hear more about, and I was able to envision, but I want to hear more about feeding the demons.
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is that to go home and find Sultra Malioni's work, and
who?
Her name is Lama Sultram, T S L U T R I M, but her last name is Alioni, A L L I O N E, and I'm happy to share afterwards. We can write it down together. But she wrote a book called Feeding Your Demons. So that gives the full exploration of the process. In my experience, and it's not like a transmission that I've received from her. It's something that I've heard her teach on, and I've kind of incorporated it, and it goes along a lot with the Shambhala, as you said, the Shambhala teachings. I start with this idea of what's the gift that I can give this demon, right? So once I invoke it, and once I begin to see it and ask that question, what does it need? And like the quality of looking into its eyes and just, what can I give this? What can I offer to it? You know, does it need food? Does it need love? Does it need a hug? Does it need a sword?
What?
A sword.
What for?
Maybe it's it needs to feel empowered to protect itself.
Got it.
So maybe it needs a sense of empowerment. Maybe it needs someone to tell it that it's not all that. That it's like so proud of itself and so kind of grandiose, just someone to say, hey, you know, you're just like the rest of us. Just like it can take on a million forms, there's a million gifts that can be given to it. And I think it's beginning to try to get a sense of what we have to offer this thing. And that will only arise, that's a little bit of the daimon quality, right? That will only arise as an instinct in us when we're willing to fully sit down with it and just be with it. And may be that in a particular session something doesn't arise of what we can give it, but then we can say, I'm going to give you my full attention. You have my full heart and mind for these 5 minutes. Explore it.
Thank you for your teachings. I think I know exactly what you're talking about, and I've given my demons a voice. Right, instead of silencing them or being embarrassed about them and thinking like, oh, it's so weird, why, right? Or trying to ignore them by like going out and being super social. I've just given them a voice and then like I'll speak for them, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not always easy in a like a super high performing type A environment. To be confused and sad or upset or taking something really hard, you know, rather than getting on with it and being grateful for what you have and everything's great and think of people who are worse off than you. Yeah. It's like, well, that's sort of abusive to the parts of you that are just having a lot of pain right now, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it speaks to the larger issue of trying to be a Buddhist in our culture where there's not a lot. There's half a beat given to I'm feeling sad. And then you move on to why you shouldn't feel sad rather than just saying, yeah, wow, sadness is a real integral part of this experience, isn't it? So I think that's what I've done for my demons is I don't know that I've done it enough, but I let them exist
yeah.
at minimum. I know that they exist, and I know that they have a right to exist, and I can give them voice sometimes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's beautiful. And what comes up for me is like, so what does their voice sound like? You know, and you don't have to answer that or even, but I'm literally saying like, is it a soft voice? Is it a very loud voice? Is it a trembly voice? Is it a no, I don't want a voice? Yeah. We're not crazy to hear voices and to cultivate that. I mean, that's not universal, right? For some people that is the obstacle, to hear the voices. But for many of us, we can allow our imaginations to do exactly like what you're saying, take us into being human. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for sharing. I was struck, I'm still new at this, and I realize I'm going to probably ascribe some words that probably have more of a duality to it, but I'm struck by how, in some ways, dramatic what you describe is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you used an entire story to explain it, and mm-hmm. stories, by definition, have drama. Yes. And I'm curious, the three words that sort of, I'm curious, I almost feel like drama and mastery are two sort of different things. When you master something, it almost seems a little less dramatic in some ways because mm-hmm. you've mastered it. Maybe you've experienced the drama, you're familiar with it, and you're sort of comfortable with it. So the one thing that sort of stood out to me was there was an element of confrontation, mm-hmm. the sort of looking into the eye. Yeah. Then there was a sort of level of eventual comfort that came with everything. So you confront, then you approach it, and there's a bit of conflict, and then you grow comfortable perhaps with that conflict. And so what I almost am curious about is mastery vis-a-vis the control that it seems like you eventually have over these things, mm-hmm. that you're almost willing to party with these demons mm-hmm. as opposed to confront them. So you confront initially, then maybe you gain some control, and eventually it's comfort. How do those, maybe those words aren't the right words, but how does that interplay with the sort of ultimate mastery of it?
Yeah, I think that's the, thank you, Misha, that's a really good question. So in terms of the drama, my experience of like our conventional notion of drama is when things feel a little bit out of control. I think maybe you even said that. And the idea of like things happen to us and we get completely thrown off our seat. So like when I slammed that brush down on the, that wasn't me controlling myself, right? That was me just being really pissed at that the world wasn't going according to the way I wanted it to, which will probably happen when I go home tonight. When we sit on the cushion, we're trending towards mastery because what we're doing is we're becoming familiar with our experience so that we're not so thrown off guard. And that requires coming back to the breath thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of times. When it's really boring, when it's really interesting and feels really good, when there are intense things coming up, we come back to the breath. That's the foundational practice. And someone said earlier, this idea that the confrontation, many of us are not very comfortable with confrontation. And so the confrontation is really, what's happening is that because we're not comfortable with some situation around who or what that demon is or what they represent, that's where there's conflict. Because again, it's not duality, right? That is us. So we have this conflict with, we have inner conflict, and every single person in this room, I would be willing to bet, has at some level inner conflict. It's not a problem. It's not a problem until we ignore it. So we heard a story early in the evening that in not confronting, not approaching that thing, and maybe just knowing that it's in the back door but not willing to sit with it and sit in what feels like conflict, drama happens. And so the mastery that I think is more a quality of familiarity. So when Max is riding the, it's really like I'm so familiar with it that I can just jive with it. Now, if he came home and then he went back to that island, no doubt that there would be a new scary monster there that he would have to meet again. It's not that we, once we get on top of the monsters, we're done. It then becomes just like the meditation. We got to come back and come back and come back and come back to that idea that mastery is really familiarity, and out of familiarity, a kindness and friendliness and gentleness towards ourself, and ultimately compassion towards ourself and what we go through all the time and our emotions. And then what's even so amazing is that we start to have that compassion for other people who we see are in that same situation. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
So thank you very much for your practice. Another book that I didn't bring tonight was as Pema Chodron. Does anyone know Pema Chodron's work? Yeah. She has a book called The Places That Scare You. And the very first quote on the frontispiece is a quote from Maciej Lobdrun about going to the places that scare you. So I offer you this invitation, this holiday season. If you have a little moment in your day, or when you have a break from work, if you do, to maybe even just entertain that we could go to the places that scare us. Have a wonderful night. Please feel free to enjoy the refreshments out in the community room.
What happens in the community room stays in the community room. Hey, thanks for listening. You too can visit our community room as well as the room where all these talks happen at the New York Shambhala Meditation Center. Every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock is our weekly Dharma gathering from which these talks are drawn. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for all of our great classes and programs, including our introductory course on meditation called Meditation in Everyday Life, beginning Thursday evening, March 2nd, or the weekend of March 3rd, our introductory weekend, Shambhala Training Weekend 1. Bye-bye.